the great Lance Barrow, who was CBS golf and football lead producer for a long, long time, one of my great friends, he told me when I started doing it, when we were working on getting ready for the season, he goes, you've got to become a golf fan. And yeah. I think that ultimately was the smartest thing in this whole situation I got into with CBS. I wasn't a big enough golf fan. So when we were talking about Ricky Fowler and guys that I knew, it was okay. And then they, all of a sudden they'd throw it to me, to some guy that I didn't even know who he was. And right. you can't really, you prepare for your window, who's teeing off. But all of a sudden, a guy on the backside in the morning, his first nine holes, he's 6 under, and I'd never heard of him. I realized that I was not as good at it as they thought I was going to be.
Hey everyone, welcome back to the Golfers Journal podcast presented by Titleist, the number one ball in golf. My name's Tom Coyne, senior editor at the Golfers Journal, your host today. Big news in golf, a lot going on right now with the FedEx, etc. But big news, the Ryder Cup team picks are going to be announced any minute, any moment. Word coming from Captain Stricker about who's going to be on the final team. So we thought it a good time to check in with two-time Ryder Cup captain and one of Stricker's vice captains for the upcoming matches in Wisconsin at Whistling Straits. It's a busy time, but Davis Love III was nice enough to give us a lot of time to talk Ryder Cup, to talk about RV life, the way to properly season a cast iron skillet. We touch on a lot of topics here, but most importantly, to you Broken Tee Society members out there, he talks about Belmont, where Golfers Journal members are going to be teeing it up on September 11th on a 12-hole routing that everybody in golf seems to be talking about. Davis and his partners, they made some really bold choices with the only other public Tillinghast to host a major championship outside of Bethpage Black. So a really special spot down in Virginia. And we get to pick Davis's brain about some of those choices they made, about turning some of it into a 6-hole short course of Tilly templates. And we get some insight into the way he's looking at golf overall as a designer. He also touches on his announcing career with a candor that I found pretty damn inspiring. All in all, if you're like me and you expected Davis Love maybe to be, or you would expect him to be sort of stoic or focused or a man of few words, maybe, well, that's the impression that I got sort of from the persona that he put out on the golf course. I could not have been more wrong. The joy of this interview was just listening to his enthusiasm for so many different subjects. So I hope you enjoy that as well. One thing that didn't come up in our talk, but certainly could have, Davis is a longtime member of Team Titleist, just like we are at the Golfers Journal, and just like you should be too. So we're excited to share with you guys exclusive opportunities from Titleist. But to be a part of them, you have to join Team Titleist. Team Titleist gives you access to opportunities like prototype testing, special events, limited edition gear from Titleist, and so much more. Sign up and join us on Team Titleist at www.titleist.com/Team Titleist. You get the white box testing opportunities, which is really, really sweet. You know, the prototype balls. You're eligible for that stuff. I mean, there's nothing like walking out to the first tee with the sleeve of Titleist with nothing on it. You feel very much like an insider, like Davis Love III, who no doubt played a lot of white-sleeved golf balls in his day. Also want to remind everyone that the August referral game, it's almost up. We are counting down the clock on that. We're giving away two more Scotty Camerons this month. And remember, we're doing it one to the referrer and one to the referred. So it's a reciprocal win-win situation to get those gorgeous Golfers Journal Scotty Camerons. And more fun as well to discuss. Number 17, it's almost here. And don't forget that in three of those number 17 issues, we're doing another golden ticket giveaway. The FootJoy golden tickets, they're up for grabs. You pretty much get everything FootJoy's ever made. from rain gear to gloves to socks. It's just, it's a beautiful package. So when you get 17, you know, look through it carefully, shake it out. You could be Charlie Buckets. This could be your time. Look for that golden ticket. I mean, these are just more reasons why subscribing is a lot more than just getting a beautiful magazine. We try to keep bringing the value. So share it with your friends. Thanks to all of you who have been referring folks. And also thanks to the sponsors from the pages of the Golfers Journal. And they are Titleist, Lynx Soul, FootJoy, Oakley, Lynx and Kings, and Scotty Cameron. And now a conversation that, quite honestly, I was pretty nervous about. I thought Davis Love might be, I don't know, sort of buttoned up or reserved, or maybe unwilling to talk about some of the subjects in my notebook. But I left this not just wanting to eat a lot of barbecue, but I wanted to hang out with Davis Love III, and that was such a wonderful surprise. All right, here with Davis Love III. Davis, thank you so much for joining us on the Golfers Journal podcast. As we just mentioned when you jumped on, I'm coming to you from Ireland a little bit later over here. But what a great way to end a day of Irish golf, to speak to yourself real quickly. Favorite Irish golf course off the top of your head? Well, since I'm over here.
I would say I haven't played enough over there. So Royal County down, I played a tour of courses, and I played a day behind Vijay Singh where we're going to the Open Championship. And I got to the Open and I said, Vijay, wasn't Royal County down great? And he goes, no, I hated it. And I go, why? He goes, there were so many blind shots. I go, well, it was the first time we played it. But it was so funny to see the ones that I liked, he didn't like, and the ones that he thought were the best ones. I was like, well, I like Royal County down better. So it was interesting, but
that is interesting.
I love it over there. It's my favorite kind of golf. I think I played 25 Open Championships in a row. Is one of my favorite tournaments. I wish I could play one more, but yeah. I'm envious that you're over there.
That's amazing. So your routine when you play the Open, would you do Ireland or would you do Scotland? Did you have like kind of a set? I mean, some guys seem to have like a set. I had a set
plan, whatever my friend John Lennon from American Express wanted to do before. I just rode along with him, and we had Brad Faxon. We had Tom Ryan from CVS Drugstores. Both Tom and John Lennon were big supporters of, you know, PGA Tour and charity golf. So we were buddies that we played together in the Seminole Pro-Am member thing. So it was whatever I could a strap hanger could jump on and play with those guys. But we did England, Scotland. Sometimes we did Ireland once or twice. Nice. But you know, they had the American Express Invitational over there a couple years. So I was very fortunate to get to play. And there was that big charity event that who was it? Dermot Desmond. Those guys. Did so anyway. I mm-hmm. played over there right. a few times. I love it. I love Lynx golf, and anybody that has any sense of history in golf, you have to go play over there some.
No doubt about it. And yeah, that's a move out of my book. Definitely attach yourself to someone who's going to really good places. And you know, it's been interesting bouncing around down here in the Southwest. How beloved Payne Stewart was. We're seeing a lot of. You know, either memorials or plaques too, because I know that was part of his routine to come over here before the Open. So it's been kind of cool to see, you know, how beloved he is in Ireland. And I know he was, you know, someone that you knew very well.
Yeah, I saw the same thing. The pictures in the clubhouse and Tom Watson was the same way. People
big time.
Who had a respect for the golf over there or for the courses or for the history and realize that it was the oldest championship and that golf was invented there. And if you had that perspective, then the fans really got behind you or the people, they welcome you to their clubs because here's the Americans coming and appreciating what they had. So yeah, I got that from Ben Crenshaw and Tom Kite and my dad. that sense of history. And, you know, I went over there when it was not easy to qualify, when you had to get there early, play a 2-round qualifier. And if you missed, it was a long ride home.
Yeah.
Fortunately, I got in every time when I went over there. And then obviously I got to where I was exempt. But my favorite thing probably in major championship golf, and I didn't get to hear it said to me, but was to go to the closing ceremony and hear them say champion golfer for the year. Yeah. So I got to watch Darren Clark and Nick Price and then my good friend Justin Leonard. Got to watch them get the claret jug. And that's one of the coolest things in sports. I think that and skating the cup and the Stanley Cup are my two favorite sports trophy presentations.
Two good ones. Yeah. What's better than those two, for sure. But as much as I'd love to keep talking about golf in Ireland, we have golf in Virginia to talk about.
Yes.
Golfers Journal subscribers are headed to Belmont, September 11th. We're having an event there, sold out really quickly. There's a ton of buzz about this place, a lot of excitement for a golf course that, well, it's got a lot of history, great design lineage, and now it's been reborn in a really exciting, creative way, and a lot of people are talking about it. What can our subscribers, when they show up there in September, what can they expect?
Something that you 100% have never seen before.
Wow.
There's not many 12 hole courses. Most people, I'm spoiled like you, that we get to go to a lot of cool places and play golf, part of our job. But a whole lot of people haven't played a short course, a 6-hole, 9-hole par three.
Yeah.
So 6-hole par three course. And then on top of that, the new rage is a putting course.
Yes.
So an acre putting course. So what they had there was 18 holes where they had land had been stolen over the years, a road through the middle of the property and holes shortened, and a clubhouse built on top of some holes. And they did not have room for 18 original Tillinghast holes anymore.
Okay.
They needed a practice facility. So for the first tee and for the community, this was the best solution, the only solution to keep the place going. I argued against it. I'm traditional. Like if I see a golf course, I want it back to original.
Right. Yeah.
I see a 57 Chevy. I don't want modern parts on it. I want the original parts on it. And that's just the way, I guess, for my dad, I always look to, let's put it back the way the designer intended. But once we looked at this project and said, look, it's going to be a parking lot or more tennis courts or pickleball courts if we don't come up with a solution. And, you know, first tee has been a big passion of mine. I was on the board of the tour when it first, Tim Fincham first came up with the idea. I've watched it grow. So the first tee supporters there in Richmond are incredible, but now the place is packed. You can't get on it. It's the new hot thing. And your subscribers are going to just love seeing something completely different. I think it's the future of golf.
You think it's the future of golf?
5-hour rounds at the country club. Most people don't have time for that. So
yeah, I hear you, Davis. I think you're right on there. And there is, and well, let's go back to Scotland. That didn't take very long. There's a 12-holer in Scotland called Shishkin on the Isle of Arran that I played and wrote about in one of my books that I thought, you know, 12 holes, it's the perfect number for a golf course if you can look past the, you know, tradition of playing 18. A front six and a back six, it was just enough time. Like 9 holes never feels like quite enough. It feels like practice, right? And 18, you can get invested with 5 hours. So there is something about, you know, 12 holes that seems to work. How did you have come around to that? If you were kind of fighting against that, how'd they convince you?
Well, you know, our architect, Scott Sherman, has a great, great vision and great at saying, here's what we have room for. Here's a routing for this piece of property. My brother, Mark, has gotten pretty good at it. He has his own tracing paper and rulers and scales. And so 9 holes were on the other side of the road from the clubhouse. So that was simple. Okay, there's 9. What do we do with this other side that there's not enough room to put a practice facility unless we abandon a couple holes? So 1 and 2 went away from the clubhouse in one direction. So there's your practice facility for the kids, for the people who come to play. And underneath the clubhouse, there was room for the putting course. And take another hole away, now we have room for the 6 short holes, and we can still have a loop of 3 holes on that side of the road. So when you pull in the parking lot, you could just get out and play 3 holes and hop back in your car. Or you could hit a bucket of balls and play 3 holes. Or you just go across the street and play 9. Or, to your point, you could play 12. So, and how many was Prestwick in the beginning? Wasn't it some, it was an odd number. Way
they
back,
were, yeah, they were all funny numbers. I mean, some of the, like Musselboro was like 6, you know, and Prestwick, most of them were 9, and you play them 4 times. And yeah,
so we have, I think we have 1 green that we didn't know what it looked like back when it was built. Uh-huh. We had a road through that changed, probably 1 green and 1 tee, maybe 2 greens. So I think we have probably 10 original, as they were designed, Tillinghast holes, greens, and then a couple that we modeled after Tillinghast. And then the 6 par 3 short holes are famous old Tillinghast greens that you would see it in a major championship or on a famous Tillinghast course. And then the putting course is, it's not our flattest putting course. It's very, I think it's very tricky, but it's fun. And that's what at Sea Island, they asked to, we need to put a beach club and a putting course behind the Sea Island Lodge. And I go, but that's the 10th fairway. And they're like, well, we're short in 10. And we're like, oh, no. And then the more we looked at it, 10 is now a drivable hole. There are more kids putting than I have ever seen in my life. It's another acre putting course. And they're out there all the time. And I see when I'm hitting balls, I see families get out of their car or pull up on their golf cart, and the kids grab their putters and they run to the putting course. So, you know, Pinehurst has a great one. We built one at Birdwood in Charlottesville, Virginia, and they're just unbelievably popular. So when they get there, I think it's just a cool idea. It's a golf place. It's not an 18-hole club. Okay. It's a place like Topgolf. You know, I thought Topgolf would never do much. Holy cow. Every town now,
they're doing all right.
They're doing all right. So I think it's just great that we can create ways. I remember my dad, when it got dark, we went from Atlanta Country Club out on the highway, and there was a par 3 course and lighted driving range. we'd play golf in the dark way, you know, back in the 70s. So I think it's coming. I think the idea of more social play a little bit faster. There's a couple, 3 or 4 that I've seen par 3 courses that are lighted. If I could practice my putting after dark, I could fish more during the day. So I think it's a great idea.
It is hot. You know, like you said, they're everywhere. And I wonder, have other people talked to you about, let's do 12 holes here, 12. If this, I think you're right. I mean, I think this kind of setup is the future of golf. I hope it continues to catch on in other municipalities. I mean, I guess similar to, you know, Winter Park down in Orlando has that vibe. A short course in a neighborhood is wonderful. And and Belmont, I can't wait to go. I'm going to be there. I'm going after the Golfers Journal event, but sounds like it has a sort of similar community vibe to it.
Yes,
which I think is that's got to be the future. That's got to be the way that we're headed. Now, as someone who came onto the tour, who's I believe still has the record for the second longest drive ever hit in competition. How do you feel about building these shorter courses, these sort of more contained golf experiences? I mean, can you let it out?
If we build a 6-hole course, we need to have some really long holes on it. But you know what very recently we've been in, there's a lot of people talking about renovating or building golf courses again. Golf has gotten hot over the last couple of years and more people are filling up the courses. But when we go into Pitch Love Golf Design, I always say, yes, I'm going to back the tees up, but I'm also going to go way farther forward than we used to go. I think the difference is now we need some shorter courses, call them family tees, forward tees, whatever you want. We need those. My son, who's bombs it, and I played with two of my nephews yesterday. And we got on the first tee, and Drew goes, look how far they rode up there. They're all the way up on the whites. And I go, but they need to be up there. It's a hard golf. It's an 8,000, you know, almost yard golf course from the back. It looks like they're way up there, but that's where they should play. But you hit it 320. You need to be way back here, and I need to be a little bit ahead of you. So I think we have to play from a lot wider range. I remember when there was two tee boxes, and then there was three. Yeah. And now sometimes there's five or six. So I think we just need to spread it out a little bit more. Longer is better and shorter is better right now.
Who won the match there? How's Drew playing? What's the scoop?
Drew is playing very well. That was like my third round back from I had a total hip replacement.
I heard you. How you feeling? Yeah, hip surgery, right?
I'm feeling great. It's great to have a ruler to measure yourself by. So when he'd hit a really good drive, I could tell, holy cow, I'm within 30 of him. That's okay.
Yeah.
It doesn't look good, but it was okay. And then I saw Zach Johnson out there, and he saw me hit a couple of four irons. He goes, man, you look like you're ready to go. I said, yeah, but that was only 205. And he goes, well, I hit five iron from there. So it's nice to be able to get, I got some of my speed back. I'm about a club, maybe half a club short right now, but I'm hitting the ball better. I'm hitting shots that I like. So I'm excited. I'm going to start playing again next week on Champions Tour.
Oh, fantastic. So you'll be back for the RSM and all that good stuff.
Oh yeah. I'll have a lot of tournaments in by the RSM. I'm going to play a whole bunch of Champions Tour events. In fact, the only one I'm going to miss is the Pure at Pebble, which is one of my favorites, but that's the week of the Ryder Cup. So I'm going to be there watching Team USA win.
Yes, you are.
Another Ryder Cup.
We definitely want to talk about that as well. I just brought up RSM because I'm going to be there. So I'll say hello to you in person. Just before we wrap, to talk about, just to revisit the architecture stuff, a Tillinghast, right? A Tillinghast that I believe Donald Ross touched it at some point. So you've got a lot of design legacy, right? Like, going into that, do you take any, I don't say like, are you nervous about touching the sacred ground, but that's, I mean, you're painting like painting over Picasso a little bit, or you're restoring a Picasso, if you will. What's that process like? And then how did you decide, I mean, did you go visit a bunch of Tillinghasts? And I mean, you know, you think of Charles McDonald and Rayner with templates. You don't think it's Tillinghast as much with templates, but he certainly has some. How was that process to figure out, all right, how do we do Tillinghast right?
Well, you try to find the old pictures. We had a few aerials, a few pictures, a few greens were untouched, basically. You know, the bunkers get higher and things get changed because of maintenance. But no, Scott Sherman, and my brother Mark and I, we all agree, let's just get it as close as possible. We did a Donald Ross in Brunswick, Georgia. We had the greens plans, and bunkers were gone. Pieces of green were abandoned. And we did a kind of an excavation project to find the old greens. But we want it back to original. We love having the plans. I know that I've lost some renovation jobs because I was so adamant that it needs to go back to original and they wanted to make it bigger or change it. Sure, we'd like to add tees. That's pretty easy because when you think about it, the ball is going whatever 20 or 30 yards farther than, you know, the modern ball has grown 20 or 30 yards. So just back up the par fours and the par fives, 20, 30, 40, 50 yards if you can, and then put some forward tees. That's easy, but the greens complexes and the bunkering and the strategy is what we want to keep original. Those guys were geniuses. And I've learned so much from Pete Dye and then from studying these old guys, renovating a few of their courses, is the strategy and the templates. They didn't just build them in a big flat place. They found the spot for the template holes. So yeah, I'm with you. I don't want to mess up what they did. I don't want to try to think what they were thinking. I just want to put it back the way it was, if you possibly can.
That's exciting though. Man, I can't wait to see this place. And that's gotta be exciting for you too. I mean, your architecture, you've done some amazing golf courses. Our intrepid assistant editor, Casey Bannon, tells me that Kinderloo Forest is one of the great underappreciated golf courses out there, one I have to get to. So, and it's exciting, and you're playing a lot, or you're about to start playing a lot again. So what an exciting time in your career, making that transition into design. What kind of education was that? And what did you have to do to say, all right, well, I know you obviously know what a good golf course is. You played a ton of them, but did you have to sit down with, you know, the spirit of St. Andrews and sort of, you know, what was that education like?
Well, first off, my dad, he was at Charlotte Country Club, Atlanta Country Club, and then at Sea Island. Mm-hmm. And everywhere he went, he was trying to make the golf course better. So I just remember him talking about whether it was agronomy or design or maintenance, trying to make the golf course better. He did a little bit of work for Sea Island when they bought a golf club, an existing club, and they did a little work to make the greens smaller and better. So he started us down this road, but then when Reese Jones and Tom Fazio came to do work at Sea Island, and I was the young, hot tour pro, they wanted to kind of include me or have my blessing or make me hit drivers off the tee to see if the hole was long enough. So they showed me how they were doing it. So 3 or 4 visits with each one of them on each course when they came was a great education. And then we had a gentleman named Bob Spence that got us started in the business. He was a good friend of my dad's. He was in the construction business. He built probably the first 6 or 8 courses that we did. And he was the old school construction guy that knew from the ground up. So we learned a lot from Bob. And I've learned a lot from Scott Sherman now on the architecture side of it. But you're right. I know what I like. Yeah. I know what I want to see. And Pete Dye gave me a great piece of advice kind of in a jab. He said, you're not a golf course architect until you get on the equipment and you learn how to build them yourself. And given that criteria, they're not a whole lot of golf course architects. Not many guys can drive the bulldozers, but I'm learning that what I see and what I want, I have to understand how it gets built. Yeah. And so I really tried to learn, well, you can't go over there because the water has to go over here, or permitting, or we can't cut those trees, or that's just too hard to build in this type of soil, or we have to have the drainage right. So I've learned a lot from the ground up side of it from other people. But again, I like traditional golf courses. For Sea Island, we built one that was more like Pine Needles, Donald Ross, and then we mm-hmm. built one that was more like template holes, more like Rainer McDonald, Travis. So we don't have a style. We just try to fit what the club needs, what the land needs, what the members need. And then, like, if you said, let's build a golf course, I go, do you like this style or do you like this style for this land? Okay. Obviously we don't do links in the mountains. We don't do mountains at the beach,
right.
But you try to fit the course to the land. We've got 4 projects kind of in the works right now, and they're all going to be completely different. You'd never know who built them if you went and played all 4 of them. They're all going to be a completely different style.
I was going to ask you, what's your design thumbprint, but it doesn't sound like you have one. It sounds like whatever fits the space.
Kinderloo Forest. I just played Chicago Golf Club a couple of times. So yeah. If you play Kinderloo Forest, you go, wow. Yeah, I get it. There's some of those angled cross bunkers. And I love playing anything McDonald, Rainer, Ross. So I have more of that kind of influence, that era. But then the more you look at it, you see where Pete Dye got it. He got it from Scotland and Ireland. Pete didn't invent railroad ties in bunkers.
I pointed that out to people. Tom Morris was doing that. You know, I went to Royal North
and Devon. They did it so the big high bunkers didn't fall down.
Exactly. And they called them sleepers. And they were using them in Scotland and England. Yeah.
So we put a bunch of railroad ties at the plantation course at Sea Island. The Harbor Town influence. You know, my dad played the first Heritage when I was a little kid. I've been going there since 1969. That had a lot of influence. But, you know, Pete's strategy, Jim Furyk, when he almost won the Players a few years ago, he hit that drive on 18 a little too close to the water. And everybody goes, oh man, he almost hit in the water. I go, watch this. He's going to make birdie. And yeah. He was so close to the water that he had a great angle to that front hole location. Well, my son Drew will tell you that the Davis Love corner over there by the cart path in the rough, you can't get on the green from over there. So the closer you get to the water on that hole, the easier it gets. And so when you see Pete just wants you to be intimidated and wants you to play closer to the bunker and have that angle into the green. And then the old architects, they did things for a reason. You see so many. Ben Crenshaw, we were at Wingfoot one time, he took me across the street to Quaker Ridge, and he goes, look, at every one of these holes has 20 or 22 yards opening in the front on these big holes, and then the short holes, then he guards the green, and then he plays over a hump in the middle of the fairway, so you can't see the green on this hole. So they all did, they used the land for strategy. Now we're spoiled a little bit with big old bulldozers and moving dirt. We can make whatever we want. So you just have to learn from the masters how they did it back in the day with literally, it's here at Sea Island, with mules and drag lines.
Yeah, right. Well, it sounds like it's been a fun experience learning this stuff. Are you more excited about building golf courses or playing golf courses, do you think?
Well, my mom would tell you that I have way too many hobbies. too many irons in the fire. I can see a time coming soon when instead of going to a construction site for a day or two every month that I do like on Gold Rush, I get an RV and I stay for two or three weeks and build it. I can see that time coming. I've watched Ben Crenshaw since all the way back at Kapalua and in Sandhills grow in his style, and his golf courses now are just so incredible. Yeah. And he has all the time in the world. I know he loved to play, but now he has all this time to go to these places. I can see that day coming. So I'm going to enjoy that. My brother Mark and I love doing it together. So, and hopefully, Drew Love will take over as the player and I can go play with the bulldozers.
There you go. the RV you mentioned, getting back to the RV life. I mean, yeah, that'll work great on a construction site. That was one of your calling cards, you know, on tour, was that you had the RV set up. Tell us a little bit about that. Do you think I wonder if they could still do that even on the tour nowadays, if you get away with
that. There's still guys that do it. It's gotten harder now. See, John Daly is ahead of his time. He was the first one.
He was first.
And then he knew that I had an RV, but I was going to horse shows with my daughter in it. And he goes, hey, just bring it to the Masters. You can park by me. I got an extra spot. So we parked behind a tire store about two blocks from the entrance to the club. And it was great. And then at Charlotte, new tournament, they put us in the parking lot and we stay in the parking lot at the Players Championship. But this is back, you know, in the early 90s. Now the Players Championship is a major and you can't get anywhere near it.
Right.
Hardly with your car, much less a motorhome. So things have kind of changed. We used to go to these great golf courses and be parked right around the corner from the clubhouse. And now they've grown up so much, there's very few you can do it. But, you know, Bubba's got one and Tim Petrovic on the Champions Tour, Jason Day, a lot of guys still do it, but it's a little more structured. Now, if I could figure out a schedule, I would probably do it again or an Airstream behind my pickup.
But maybe while you're on the road in your RV, I read where you talked about you did some smoking of some fine meats. Is that where the barbecue thing comes from? Were you always a barbecue guy, or is that where you got into smoking meat? Because Southern soul, it's good stuff.
My brother-in-law got me into cooking barbecue. He was an expert barbecue cook, had a barbecue team. And I was an assistant on his team, some just learning. And then he passed away. So I took over all the equipment and started trying to do it myself. And then Southern Soul Barbecue on St. Simon's came along, and I got involved with that. And again, there's another hobby. And because of my love of barbecue and having too many smokers, now I'm trying to learn to weld on smokers, and it just goes down a rabbit hole. But I was just on another barbecue show, so I'm not very good. I love doing anything challenging and outside. You know, if it's an outside activity, again, Drew and I just, we play golf one day, we go fishing one day, go hunting the next day. We're always outside doing something.
You know, what's any secret to doing good barbecue, or what makes barbecue great for you? Do you have any tips for the listeners on how to get it just right? I just got my first smoker. I haven't used it yet. I'm not quite sure how it works.
Patience.
But I'm going to try. Patience.
Patience is the key. You know, I asked this old guy cooking in a restaurant in Tulsa one time. I said, "So how long are you smoking those ribs?" He said, "Until they're done." And I went, "Okay, I won't ask you any more questions." But yeah, you have to have patience with it. It's not that hard. You know, if you're using a pellet or charcoal, but if you're burning wood, and smoking a big piece of meat, it's just time. Like we say in the golf course design, it's just money and dirt. We can build whatever you want. It's just smoke and meat. And if you take your time and keep your temperature the same, really anybody can do it. It takes a long time. You know, take a brisket that's 15 pounds, you might put 18 hours into it. It takes a long time to do it. My problem is that I get the ADD thing going. I start with one or two briskets, and the next thing you know, there's chickens in there and there's sausage, and I'm trying to do too many things. And then I'm practicing my putting and I forget to put wood in the fire. And so you got to be focused and patient. And two of my things that I really need to work on and off the golf course.
Is it true that you collect, a friend told me you collect cast iron skillets. Is that true?
Yes.
What do you do with cast iron skillets?
A couple of weeks ago, my daughter brought over a skillet, and she goes, "Look what my husband did to my iron skillet." I'm like, "Oh my goodness." So I had to reseason her skillet.
What did he do?
But he put it in the sink and left water in it.
That's what I do. I shouldn't do that.
My mom grew up on a farm in North Carolina. And as she would tell you, a working farm, it's where their food came from. And so I learned a lot of stuff cooking wise, but I grew up, every meal was prepared in a cast iron skillet when I was a little kid. So I made a fried bologna sandwich today in a cast iron skillet.
You did?
Today.
Yeah.
That's what I had every day going to school. But yeah, my mom was an unbelievable cook. All of her sisters were great cooks. So I learned the iron skillet. And then again, you get obsessed with, I got to have a number 12. I got to have a number 11. I need a bigger one. I need a smaller one. Next thing you know, you can't open the drawer because you got too many skillets in it.
How should I be seasoning this thing? Because I'm doing what your son-in-law's doing, I guess. It's getting rusty. It gets rusty in my wife, because I have one nice one, but I don't think I'm taking care of it right.
Well, you can fill it full of Coke and let it eat the rust away, or you can put some oven cleaner in it and get the rust off real good. But then the secret is just put regular old cooking oil on it, put it in the oven at 500 and let it a light coat of oil, and just let it get seasoned, and do that a couple times, and then cook on it, cook bacon in it, and cook fried chicken in it, and just don't put a whole lot of soap in it when you clean it. Just scrape it off, and you know, you're building a patina on it that you don't want to, like your old golf course, you don't want to rub it all off. You want to keep that old patina on it.
We got to talk about, I got to ask you about the Ryder Cup. It's a Ryder Cup year. Yes, you tell America's going to win, right? As you just explained, but how are they going to do it? How important is team chemistry? The storyline, of course, right now that not everyone's sending each other Christmas cards, maybe on the team. Maybe that's to our advantage. I don't know.
I explained to someone the other day, family, that the captains aren't worried about team chemistry we've had other teams that I've played on and been around that we might have been worried about it, but we're not worried. We don't even hardly talk about it. I think that's if the media asks me enough times about golf course design, I'm going to say something that offends somebody. If you just keep asking this, they keep asking, and it can't go away because they keep asking. I don't think we have a problem. I don't think they're going to sit beside each other on the bus, just like at one time Tiger and Phil didn't sit beside each other on the bus, but we all get along and we all have fun. And you know, I think it's one of those things that's been blown a little bit out of proportion, but
yeah.
I would want to play with Bryson, and I would want to play with Brooks. They're both really good. So I don't think we're going to have an issue finding them a partner or, you know, and it's a small team, but when you get there, you know, Tiger and Phil are partners in ping pong, and this group over here don't play ping pong. So it's not clicky, but it's not like everybody's sitting in the same chair on the same couch the whole time.
Wait, there's set ping pong teams.
Oh yeah. Tiger and Phil like to play together.
On the same team.
Oh, on the same side. Yes.
Wow.
And when they're both healthy, they're really good. And they like Kuchar's playing against each other too. Huh?
Kuchar's a good player. I've seen.
Kuchar is the best. Yeah.
Kuchar's the best.
Unbeatable on the US team. Let's put it that way.
Really?
Yeah. Unbeatable. Now Brad Faxon and Kuchar have never been on the same team though. So different generations, but Brad Faxon's really good too.
So the ping pong table is a must in the team room.
Table tennis, we have to call it.
All right. We have to call
it table tennis because it's very serious. Tom Watson called me when he was captain, and I had just been captain, you know, in 12. And he goes, "Hey, let me ask you some stuff about the team room. Like, does this?" He goes, "Do we really need 3 ping pong tables?" And I said, "Tom, it's your team, but I'm going to tell you one thing. Do not take the ping pong tables away from them. The rest of it, you do whatever you want, but you will have anarchy, revolt if you take the ping pong tables away from him." But that's him. He, all the way back to 93, we had Jenga and Pass the Pigs, and we were playing late at night, and he tried to take them away from us, make us go to bed. Like, no, we're having fun.
Dude, Pass the camp. Pigs. Pass the Pigs is a great game. I can't believe you're playing Pass the Pigs. This little thing stand up on their nose.
Pass the Pigs for about 3 Ryder Cups. And then Christmas is at our house and others because of that. Pass the Pigs was a big deal. You had to bring Pass the Pigs and you had to bring Born in the USA back when we had tapes and CDs. You had to bring the Born in the USA CD to play in the mornings at the Ryder Cup. So
is that that was your fire up music? Little Bruce?
That was, yeah. And I think it was, I don't know, Tony Azinger or who would bring it. But when we had jam boxes and CD players and
yeah.
Hey, I don't know what's going to happen in the Ryder Cup, but I can tell you that when we get, we've got 2 team things coming up, a dinner and a practice round trip. Everybody's fired up about it. Stricker did a great job in 17. We had, you know, similar group of guys, you know, some guys get along, some guys don't. Stricker did a great job in New York in 17. Those guys just rolled it. I don't see any problems other than getting too excited, too anxious. That's the only thing I think we do is we try too hard. We get too excited, getting our own way a little bit, but, I think it's a perfect golf course for us. You know, it's going to be iffy on the weather. We had a bunch of long hitters, a bunch of great ball strikers, a bunch of great wedge players, which is kind of strange to say, but we're looking at the stats. We got a bunch of great wedge players and we're going to really need that on that golf course. It's long. You're probably going to miss some fairways. You're going to par fives. You might not be able to get to. So I think we're set up good. Now, their top 6 and our top 6 are generally pretty even. The bottom 6 on both teams, we should win, but they have a bottom 6 that seems to rise to the occasion for Ryder Cups. I don't know why. All the way back to Colin Montgomery, or, you know, guys that you, there's been three or four guys in my time of playing we had never even heard of, and they come in and just crush you. So it's just depends on who gets on a roll, who makes the putts. That's what it boils down to.
Well, Davis, talking, this is my first time ever talking to you, and it is, it's just been an absolute pleasure. You are so engaging and have so many interesting things to say. I'm sitting here thinking that it's a, so now another change in your life that you decided to go away from broadcasting. I'm sitting here thinking you'd be a great broadcaster. But you were really honest, I thought, and it was very refreshing talking about that decision. And actually, and facing, you know, nerves in that, in those moments, you know, someone that I, as you know, I always sort of idolized your approach as a golfer, the way you looked on the golf course, you just always looks very steady. But it did sound like maybe there were some nerves behind the scene. And then there were, you mentioned a few times, you know, nerves associated with, you know, someone putting a microphone in front of your face and saying, say something. What's that, what was that like? And why was that, you know, God, you've played in the biggest stages, you know, then how did the broadcasting become a challenge?
Well, I think, I kind of know the subject and I kind of know the players, but I wasn't really good at getting my thoughts out quickly. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't reacting to, and the great Lance Barrow, who was CBS golf and football lead producer for a long, long time, one of my great friends, he told me when I started doing it, when we were working on getting ready for the season, he goes, you've got to become a golf fan. And I think that ultimately was the smartest thing in this whole situation I got into with CBS. I wasn't a big enough golf fan. So when we were talking about Ricky Fowler and guys that I knew, it was okay. And then they, all of a sudden they'd throw it to me, to some guy that I didn't even know who he was. And you can't really, you prepare for your window, who's teeing off, but all of a sudden a guy on the backside, in the morning, his first nine holes, he's 6 under, and I'd never heard of him. Well, that was, I could fake it a little bit, but then then you get nervous and you get off. And when it, I realized that it, I was not as good at it as they thought I was going to be, if that makes any sense.
Yeah,
it does. They thought I was going to be great, and I wasn't. And we all were trying to get me to be great. And I, at the same time, we had COVID come in. So the whole broadcast situation changed. We were offsite. We unfortunately lost our house in a fire. We had a whole lot of things pile up all at once that were just not a good situation for me. My friend Lance Barrow retired as I was starting, and it was his last year. It was just a confusing year for me and for all of golf, really. I'm sitting in a studio in Orlando and covering a golf tournament in Detroit that I've never played the golf course. I couldn't go there and see the golf course. It's
not a great recipe.
It was 100% an air ball by me, but, I'm still great friends with everybody at CBS. We didn't burn any bridges. We're just saying, hey, timing was really bad for all of us. You know, let's don't go farther down this. And frankly, I realized watching that I should be playing. And you know, I always say God has a plan. It's worked out really well. They're on a roll. Their telecasts look great. I ended up having to have my hip replaced and another couple little surgeries, which whether I played golf or not, I would have had to have done. So it all worked out well.
It sure did. I think,
and I hope to play golf on CBS a lot in the next year. I've got a lot of goals I want to finish off in my golf career before I start my bulldozer golf course construction phase.
You're a busy guy. It sounds like you're getting busier. Yeah, very busy. You know, that's fantastic. And to have that perspective, to have all the success you've had and still be able to have the perspective to say, hey, wait, this one thing I'm not awesome at everything. You know, not everyone can do that when the ego gets involved. And that's just that. I think that sort of humility is the mark of successful people. And it's really something. It's great to listen to. You mentioned your house. How are things? You said you look like you're sitting in a beautiful office. are you into a new space now? What happened after the fire?
We immediately bought a house. I didn't want my wife to have to sit through, you know, rentals and building and
what do we do.
So we bought a house real quick, which we were very lucky. We got it before COVID really hit hard and got settled. So I do have my first paneled office I've ever had. My
sharp,
granddaughter,
man. The wood paneling is sharp.
My 6-year-old granddaughter uses it more than me. She loves to come in here and hang out. But I have a couple Ryder Cup bags. You know, it's been really hard on my wife. You know, it really doesn't ever get any easier. But we're moving on. We got a great house and our granddaughters love it. And we may build again one day, but we're counting our blessings. You know, there's so many bad things going on in the world. We just lost a bunch of stuff. But we're happy, healthy, and moving forward.
Dave, thank you so much for your time. This has been a thrill, and it's just been wonderful to speak with you. Wishing you all the success on the course and building new ones.
Thank you, and have fun the rest of your trip in Ireland.